there's a memorial exhibition of the work of William Basiotis in the museum at the present time, and this lecture accompanies it. I arranged the exhibition, and most of the things I had to say, I have to say, feel most strongly about in connection with Basiotis are said in the catalog. But the catalog costs $4.50, and some people have got out of the habit of reading. So here it is in lecture form, in capsule form, lasting under 60 minutes, some of the things that I feel about Basiotis' art. Here, compressed, will be some of the things which you can find at greater length and with more substantiating detail and with quotations from the artist himself in that catalog. There's one difference, however, between writing a catalog and giving a lecture, and in this case, the difference has to do with the visual aids. We have a big screen, and a big screen looks very good if you pair the illustrations. So the main difference between what I had to say about Basiotis in the catalog and what I have to say about him this afternoon just is a consequence of using a screen which will take two slides. I've paired everything, and I've paired, in several cases, artists with whom I think Basiotis' work can be connected. Now, it's not a question if you put a work by artist A and a work by artist B together, one can be certainly indicating influences. But one has to beware also and remember that when one indicates an influence, one is also indicating a difference, a transformation. And although, for example, I'm going to show some paintings by Miró in relation to paintings by Basiotis, what's important is not only the connection we might find, but also the differences that exist, the extraordinary transformations that go on too. As a matter of fact, if you were to see that catalog of Basiotis, you will find that one of the themes that occurs in his statements is the theme of a community of artists. He felt, and increasingly later in life, I think, that one artist always had a kind of particular contact, particular kind of communication with other artists. The profession they were in, the secret problems and operations of art made links between one painter and another. So maybe all I'll be pointing out will be the community of artists effect when I link Basiotis with other artists. Let me give you, which will just be a repetition of the catalog, partially, an outline of the way Basiotis developed between 1942 and 1962, starting with early work of 42. At this time, in the early 1940s, American art was, American artists were much concerned with the problem of breaking down the geometric structures of earlier abstract art. And you can see in these two paintings two of the ways in which it was done. The painting on the left is Basiotis' Mirror at Midnight, done in 1942. And the painting on the right, done in the same year by Mata, is called Disasters of Mysticism. Both paintings are 1942, and both represent ways of turning the automatic art of the surrealists into painting. Most of the automatic art of the surrealists stays graphic, it's draftsmanship. They doodled, as it were, when they made telephone calls, but they didn't turn the doodling, they couldn't turn it into a fully painterly vision. What happened in New York in the early 40s is that improvisation and automatic art was expanded to a full painterly scale. And you can see it in two very different ways in Basiotis and Mata here, both artists who knew one another and were in contact with one another at this time. Basiotis, after the period of improvisation represented by the Mirror at Midnight, developed in a more structural direction, a direction seen especially perhaps by the painting on the left, which is called Parachutists and was painted in 1944. But as he developed a more structural form, he nevertheless preserved all that psychological atmosphere, all that feeling of improvisation producing deep, secret psychological meanings which had characterized the automatic art of the earlier 40s. In Parachutists, for example, you can see, I think, and this was something that Mrs. Basiotis pointed out to me, that this compartment, and this compartment breaks down into three figures. And here, a later painting on the other side, the painting is called The Mirror, done in 1948, 4 years later. Again, it's one, two, three. And this triple form of three forms occurs time and again in Basiotis' art in various manifestations, various forms. And what I want to do is indicate, by using the paired images on the screen, some of the ways in which images slowly are transformed and then reappear as one looks at his art in time. Here are two works in which, painted soon after Parachutists in 1944, the one on the left is Night Figure, number one, drawing of about 1946, and on the right-hand side, the green painting, is The Web, definitely painted in 1946. And what happened is this. We, in Basiotis, first of all, the improvisatory method of working, then that grid inhabited by blossoming figures like the Parachutists, and then, in the middle the 40s, a definite effort, I think, is being made to firm up the structure. He's enlarging the forms, firming them up, and he's creating a kind of large, ample, simple structure which stands him in very for good stead later on through his paintings. Paintings of this kind, I think, show him providing a kind of architectural basis which in his later, softer, more fluid pictures still enables him to keep a very firm control. Now, the painting on the left, and the painting on the left is always going to be by Basiotis. The painting on the right often won't be. This is the clue to that. The painting on the left is a Night Landscape of 1947. And the painting on the right is by Barnett Newman, and it's called The Song of Orpheus. Now, one of the great themes, I think, of New York painting in the 1940s is everybody wanted to get away from geometric art. Everybody wanted to get away from that kind of formality and patterning. And one of the ways to do it was via myth, the fact that the drawing on the right is called Song of Orpheus. You can see that Orpheus, the mythical figure, because when he sang, could make vegetation responded, as well as animals, as well as people. So that here is a landscape on the right, full of life and human vitality, and a kind of human life spills over into the entire landscape. On the left, Basiotis, the very fine painting called Night, and as I say, called Night Landscape, shows something similar happening. You don't have Orpheus to point to particularly, but nevertheless, one can see the space that's evoked is a landscape space, but it's not a particularly observed landscape. It's a landscape which is mysteriously and poetically evoked. And this landscape theme, a theme which is no specific place, but is full of evocative form, is a standard element in the later works of Basiotis. I'm showing it here linked with Newman, not because I think there's any influence between them, there isn't, but just to show you that his concern, Basiotis' concern with organic life as it spills over human boundaries into the whole world, possessing an animating landscape, is a shared theme in New York at that time. Here are two more examples to make the same point. The painting on the left is called Night Mirror. Again, the nocturnal theme, night, Night. It occurs in many paintings of his time. Night Mirror, and the painting on the right, is a famous Ashiel Gorky called The Liver is the Cock's Comb. And if you look at the Gorky, you will see, I think, that here we have a space which is like a landscape, but it's a landscape which is packed with intestines, bits of animals, sexual organs, Lord knows what. It's a great kind of salad of every kind of anatomical and floral, every kind of human and farmyard kind of organ and form may be there. Comparing Gorky with his proliferating vision to Basiotti's Night Mirror obviously is to move from one artist to another artist, from one world to another world. But nevertheless, I think there is in common this feeling of art not as something, not as art, of art as something which is mysteriously psychological, soaked in the dreams and mysteries and secrets of the artist, not as something clear and firm and architectural as in, say, the geometric art of the period. And in this Basiotti's, you'll see again, I think, 1, 2, 3. Again, that triple grouping of forms, again, that triad, that constantly recurring organizational thing in his work. But again, looking back one to another from the distance of 20 years or so, or a little less, whatever it is, one can see, I think, that there is this vision of form, not of life, not as something restricted only to the human, but as something which spills over and animates all kinds of natural and created forms. And that, I think, is what links the two paintings, although, as I say, the actual formal characteristics of both are very different. Here are two Basiotti's of 1947. The one on the left is called Water Form. The one on the right is called Dwarf. And perhaps you will see here, I think, very clearly what I mean by this interest, the ambiguity with which human forms are represented by Basiotti's. If you look at the right, you can see very distinctly a human outline, a human contour, basic human distribution of head and body. If you look on the left, you don't necessarily get such a strong feeling of the human in the picture called Water Form. Nonetheless, the picture called Water Form curves and bulges like a body. It looks partially perhaps like one of those wine sacks that one drinks out of. That people drink out of. It looks like one of those wine sacks. And that wine sack form possibly recurs in Dwarf. Although the image of Dwarf is compact and simple and legible, nevertheless, Basiotti manages to keep it very open as to various associations. He's dealing with an evocative form. It's multi-evocative form. And in a way, I think multi-evocative imagery is at the basis of his work. And he shows that multi-evocation is compatible with great economy and simplicity in his forms, because the monumental characteristics which he created, established around 46, persist, I think, in these paintings, but now softened and fully assimilated to his painting style. Here is a Basiotti's on the left, Cyclops, painted in that extraordinary year in which Dwarf was painted, and various other, I think, very fine paintings, the nocturnal landscapes, for one thing, and also a run of very fascinating figure subjects. Now, one of the conspicuous things in Cyclops, clearly, is the eye. The myth of Cyclops has to do precisely with that. And the eye, as is discussed somewhat in the catalog, has various sources and various meanings for Basiotti's. One thing one needs to mention, however, and next to it is a drawing by Paul Klee of 1934 called Troubled. One needs to mention the fact that the eye has been a persistent and recurring symbol in anti-abstract modern art. Ben Nicholson, years ago, when he was defending his position as a pure geometric abstract painter, was very scornful. He said, all those painters, he says, who you know, do a few curves and they put an eye or a nipple on it and they think they've you know, created a human form. Well, in a way, Nicholson, in his scornful way, describes precisely what Klee and Miró and Baziotis and Gorky are, in fact, have done, and done with very richly human results. But the point I want to make is that Klee is one of those artists who has developed the mythology of floating, hanging, enlarged eye, and Baziotis has also used it. Here is another example of it in the figure on the left is the Baziotis, called Mirror Figure, done in 1948, and the figure on the and the one on the right is a Juan Miró called Ballet Dancer Listening to Organ Music in a Gothic Cathedral, and was done in 1945. And if you look in the upper part of the Miró, you will see an eye with those concentric rings, firm concentric rings. And if you compare that with the eye in the Mirror Figure, you will see that, again, we can make a link between Baziotis and other anti-geometric, pro-human image artists of the 20th century. Again, let's stay with Miró for a moment. On the left is Night Form by Baziotis. On the right is Miró's composition, 1925. And one can see, I think, that both these artists belong to a tradition which hasn't been very clearly defined. The history of modern art has tended to be written in terms of cubism or straight surrealism or geometric art. But there's been this also very strong, persistent tradition of evocative, biomorphic human imagery as well. And Miró, Baziotis both belong in it, and it hasn't really been adequately defined yet, I think, as one of the staples of 20th century iconography. Here, for example, on the right, you can see Miró's sexy sack. On the left is a Baziotis, which presents a form also suspended, not humanly resting on the ground or standing in a gravity-bound situation, but floating, hovering, and yet full of references to human organs and the human image. Two Baziotis on the screen together now, both of 1950. Both, I think, very good ones. The one on the left, the green one, is called The Mummy. The one on the left is Moon Animal. And one of the things which I think is fascinating about Baziotis, and which the more one looks at his paintings, the more one becomes attuned to, is the repetition and change, the continuity and shift which goes on in his forms. For example, the mummy hangs, it's a floating form again, hangs, as you see, yellowish green against the greener background. The moon animal, the pink one, on the other hand, rests and touches the bottom of the painting. But they are both definitely, I think, of the same formal family. They both bend at about the same place. They both have heads in the upper left and something else at the bottom of the painting. There's a definite formal resemblance between the two creatures, despite the fact of the great difference between the two paintings. And keeping to this biomorphic line for a little longer, let me compare the Moon Animal of 1950, the pink one, with the picture on the left, Baziotis of 1956, this one, which is called Moon World. Which is called Moon World 56. Now you can see that the 50 moon, that the 1950 moon animal and the 1956 moon world are dealing, basically portraits of the same creature, the same form. And something of the classicism and restraint, I think, might be found, an analogy for it can be found, I think, in this celebrated Brancusi. It's Brancusi called Miracle, the White Seal, which was done in 1936. And it seems to me that translated into the forms of painting, we get that form of Brancusi's coming up again. It's part of that family of organic, not precisely human, but equally not inhuman forms, which I'm trying to indicate the course of. I myself don't doubt that there must have been a reference to Brancusi intended in this tapering, flowing creature, and I think this picture may make that point. But there are other possible connections. Here, for example, on the left is a painting of 1950 called Dying Bird, and on the right is Young Bird of 1925 by Brancusi. That theme of the eye is one of the recurring themes in this kind of art, biomorphic art. Birds are another of the themes which recur constantly in this kind of clay, Brancusi, Miro, Basiotis tradition. And one of the strange things about the bird of Basiotis in this case, it always seems strange to me, here's this great curve which reminds one a little bit of the seal, still reminds one of the seal of Brancusi, but the fact that it doesn't quite go into wings, it doesn't quite go into legs, the support, the whole form is a little unexpected. One finds it a little hard to identify one's own body with the image, although it's so obviously organic. And possibly that strange form of Brancusi's might offer a clue. The fact of a bird without the obvious references to bird, without any of the organic apparatus, just this simple, stripped, purified organic form. Let me show you another bird. This one's a painting called Flight of 1950 by Basiotis, done the same year as Dying Bird. And here is another view of the Brancusi, of the young bird of 25. And again, it seems to me there's something in the economy and balance and surprise of the forms which suggests a link in the common bird imagery. Another Basiotis, called of 1952, this one, on the left called The Flesh Eaters. And on the right, a Miro of 1926 called Person Throwing a Stone at a Bird. And of course, the thing about suggesting influences, what happens is, A, maybe you see a link, and if you do, you also see the tremendous differences. It seems to me that there is a possible link between certain forms, for example, that white, the white form on the extreme right of the Miro might be connected possibly with the gray form there in the Basiotis, in the Flesh Eaters. But it's not so much a question of locating exact roots by which, you know, by which a particular image was transmitted, but the correspondence that exists between the two. And another theme which is of importance in Basiotis' art and is these tendrils. These also occur a good bit in Miro, as I'll show in a moment. The decisive fact, I think, is that any influences that one might be able to point to are all transformed into Basiotis' vision, but they also become the most beautiful painting. The originals, one doesn't think of Miro particularly in terms of marvelous painting, but look at this detail from the Flesh Eaters, and one can see that anything that might be taken from Miro is totally assimilated to a highly painterly vision. American painters tend to think of themselves as always, they have a kind of pioneer image which they live happily, contentedly within, whereas in fact, the history of American painting, I think, in the 40s is often a history of borrowing ugly European originals and assimilating them into beautiful painting. And certainly Bessie Otis, I think, does this dashingly and marvelously, as you can see in this absolutely vast detail of a few inches of the flesh eaters. Still trying to fill up that great screen, like the early CinemaScope makers used to have everybody lie down so that it filled the big horizontal screen. Here I am doubling everything up, suitable or not. On the left, The Net by Bessie Otis of 1953, and on the right, a painting by Adolf Gottlieb called Voyager's Return. What I wanted to do is not suggest an influence between one man and the other, but rather that they shared how widespread this interest in a primal world, this interest in a primeval world was in New York. Here, for example, a form like this, one can find echoes of it in something like that, something like this. I mean, I'm aware of the differences, but nevertheless, one can see various kinds of primitive organism being used as the basis for form invention in both of these paintings. I mentioned that use of fronds in Miró. Here they are as a peasant's beard. And, you know, those fronds reappear as various kinds of marine flora in Bessie Otis and with other meanings. And here on the right-hand side is a mirror called Head of a Peasant, done in 1924-25. On the left, marvelous Bessie Otis called Pompeii, done in 1955. And I'm showing it, I'm putting the two together partly because I wanted to indicate how this organic frond-like form with its anti-Mondrian, anti-geometric, organic flutter is common to both artists, and also because there's a fascinating thing about the Bessie Otis, it's a kind of duplex composition with form here, the tendrils reaching up, and then a panel up here. The picture is sort of, there's a kind of hesitation at the center, which is very interesting. It seems to me that the head of a peasant also has a kind of central gap between what happens above and what happens below. Here are two Bessie Otis. Bessie Otis, after those landscapes of 47, tended, I think, to go in for portraits of various biomorphic forms, from dwarf right through to the net, say, or the flesh eaters. Then, in the middle 50s, about 55, he resumed his landscape interests. And here are two of them. On the left, you see the painting of 1955 called The Beach. On the right, the red landscape of 1956. And the painting becomes more scenic. It's less portraits of individual animals and phantasms and amoebic creatures and marine life and prehistoric life. There's much less of that and much more of the spatial effect of landscape. The animals persist, however, though, as I say, a slightly more spacious landscape setting. Here, for example, is Moby Dick on the left, the blue one, and Mammoth on the right, painting of 55, Moby Dick, 57, Mammoth. And here are two examples of use of monsters by, monstrous forms by Bessie Otis. People have overdone, I think, the feeling of calmness that exists in his work. Here is the mammoth, there is Moby Dick. And you can see, I think, considerable similarities between the forms, and yet at the same time, the extraordinary shifts and differences that exist between them at the same time. This the tension of themes, which is always changing and varying, can be seen very clearly, I think, in these two paintings. The one on the left is called Flight of 56, the one on the left is Green Night of 57. And here you get that platform effect, a platform effect on the right, a landscape effect on the left, with comparable forms, one above the, in the upper part of the painting, and linear unwinding forms in the lower part. It's the considerable formal correspondences between the two paintings. But what happens, I think, is that the organic feeling, of the feeling of organic life, which is so strong in the earlier Basiotis, I think tends to change and shift in the later work. Here, for example, is White Bird of 57 on the left and Mist on the of 58 on the right. And what's happening is, I think, is a more mineral quality is coming, is appearing. The forms look a little bit less like our own flesh, strangely transformed, or the curious pets of our prehistoric ancestors, or something like that, or possibly our prehistoric ancestors themselves. There's much less a feeling of organic life and a much greater feeling of sharp surfaces, hard outer edges and surfaces in these two paintings. If you compare, this white bird, here's the bird, but it's spread out and sharpened in a way that makes it look like a fantastic piece of jewelry, just as much as it looks like a fantastic creature. So that the creatural element persists, but the element of jewels, the element of the mineral, I think, increases. I think this is true, too, of paintings like this. On the left, Dusk of 58, on the right, Scepter 60, 61, and I think you can see that what used to look perhaps somewhat marine and landscapey has now turned into a kind of almost solid wall. It's almost solid rock wall, and the lines across it look like inscriptions on a wall, on a rock wall, or just in front of a rock wall. There's a greater feeling of the mineral as opposed to the organic here. And in the late paintings, what happened, the very late paintings of the 60s, on the left is Serpentine, on the right is Opalescent. Serpentine is 61, Opalescent is 62. His color lightened and lightened and lightened, but without, I think, resuming the organic property of the earlier work. Instead, the feeling is, I think very strongly, of the pearly, of pearls, of topaz, of looking into jewels and so forth. I understand from Mrs. Basiotis that, in fact, the artist did had a great attraction to jewelry and often looked through it, examined it, looked at the shifting lights in stones. And I think that property comes through very much in these later works. And in a way, maybe one could sum up what's happened is that if you look at Serpentine on the left, that form, a few years earlier, it would have been an eel, but now I think it's seaweed. So that there's a pulling back of identification with organic life and an increase of either floral or mineral references. Well, in a kind of compressed way, that's the profile I wanted to indicate of some of the ground, of some of the aspects that one can discuss about Basiotis, starting in 42, finishing with Opalescent on the right in 1962. I wanted to indicate connections with other American artists and this interest in a primal landscape. I wanted to indicate connections with biomorphic artists like Miro and Brancusi in the past, with this tradition of interest in life, even taking slightly non-human forms. I wanted to indicate that, and if I could, however rapidly, something of the artist's development, i.e. his change. But at the same time, I wanted to suggest ways in which, even as he changed, he preserved certain constants, certain constant forms, certain groupings of forms and these elements of this kind, I think, hold. I think those are the things I wanted to say about Basiotis, but I should remind you that the exhibition is on, and it's upstairs in this museum.